The Daily Buzz is made possible with support from Studio Movie Grill, opening hearts and minds one story at a time. A trip to SMG is unlike any other entertainment experience. Whether you come early or stay late, we'll set the mood for a great night to socialize and connect with an immersive movie-going experience. And independent filmmakers, you can four-wall your film or find a home at the many film festivals they host in their 30 locations across the country. And Onward, a search-driven brand experience agency. In today's heads-down society, people crave relevance, emotional connection, and honest information. Our pioneering search-first process delivers the credible insights for informed marketing communications. You're listening to The Daily Buzz on KCPW.org, MovieCityNews.com, and You Offend Me, You Offend My Family. This is Day 7. I'm John Wildman, and we are on location in Park City, Utah, at the 2018 Sundance Film Festival. We're coming to you from the Slam Dance headquarters on historic Main Street, interviewing some of this year's most important and exciting voices in the independent film world. Joining me this morning are my co-hosts Minji Chang and Lancia Wan. And today, we will be talking about the Sundance films, Genesis 2.0, with the director Christian Frey and co-director Maxim Arbugaev, and the writer with that film's director, Chloe Zhao, as well as a special segment on girl power shorts with Anna Margaret Holliman, who's the director of Maud, and Emily Hoffman, who's the director of Nevada. We are back on The Daily Buzz. This is John Wildman. I'm here with my co-host, Minji Chang. And right now we're going to do a segment we're calling Girl Power Shorts. We have with us Anna Margaret Holliman, who directed Maud, and Emily Hoffman, who directed Nevada, two very, very cool shorts. And I'm really quickly, because I want to get a lot of stuff in with both of you, we're going to have you introduce the audience to your films. So Emily, why don't you go first on Nevada?
Sure. So Emily Ann Hoffman here. My short film is called Nevada, and it's a stop-motion animated comedy about a young couple who has a birth control mishap.
And there's a lot of discussion about birth control. This is great. Yeah. Anna Margaret.
My name's Anna Margaret Holliman, and I made a short called Maud. It's about a girl named Teeny who shows up for what she thinks is a routine babysitting job, only to find out that the person on the other side of the door is someone she may have gone to college with. And then she may pretend that the baby she's babysitting is hers for a day, and she may get caught. I don't know.
Maybe.
We'll have to see it.
Well, one thing I loved about Maud was that idea of usurping personas and kind of on the fly, going with the lie and then having to go with the lie and then kind of enjoying going with the lie. So where did the idea come from?
Yeah, well, I've been very lucky to be an independent film actress, which is, I have a very rich and artistic life, which means I have no money in my bank account. So I've had a variety of survival jobs, and one of them was babysitting, which I thought was a really cool job as I was approaching 30, because I was like, look, like, no one's going to know that I'm doing this, right? And then I was, I would be bartending and waiting on people that I knew every day. So I just finally realized as I was approaching these women's doors that I was very close in age to them. I keep saying the same thing, which is like the women just kept getting younger and I kept getting older. So I started to kind of go, what would happen if, it was somebody that I went to school with, and just kind of grappling with my own inadequacies as a artist, as a professional, and as a woman, I guess, and wondering why I couldn't get my shit together, or and beating myself up about it. And then I also feel like a lot of women I've spoken to who've babysat, I don't know, maybe you've done this, but like sometimes when you're babysitting a baby, people assume it's yours because you are a woman. And so you just pretend it's yours. You just say things like, yeah, she's 2 months old or whatever. And you move on. And I had a girlfriend once who actually went into a store and was mistaken for another woman. And the shopkeeper was like, I just saw your husband and baby. Oh my God, the baby's so cute. And the dog's so cute. And how are you doing? And my friend just was like, great. We're great. And went along with it and left the store and was like, why did I do that? And it's part of like women, I think, having to be polite all the time and not wanting to correct people, mm-hmm. which I hope is now changing. But also it's kind of fun and harmless.
I think what's great about and what connects both of these films is that factor of being able to identify.
you know, in both cases. And, you know, and certainly in Nevada, I think plenty of couples have had those similar conversations, you know, and, you know, some kind of awkward, sometimes charming, sometimes, you know, delightful, sometimes not so delightful. But why stop motion animation?
Yeah, so that's the question I get most often, because it's a story that could have been done in live action, and I definitely considered it for a little while. But first off, I'm an animator. That's my background, so I'm comfortable with that medium, and I really like controlling everything. It's easier to control puppets than humans. And then the other part is that I really wanted, obviously, it's a comedy, so I'm handling the subject with humor, and part of that is when you see a naked human form on screen, it's really hard not to immediately sexualize that, especially as women. You see a female body, and you're so used to sexualizing her immediately. So by making them puppets, they're kind of like wonky looking, and they're not perfect because I handmade them. It's not a sexy movie. It's about sex to a degree, but it's more about the conversations they have surrounding sex. And stop motion also is a very visceral medium because it's physical objects that you're working with, and it's a story about what's going to happen to this woman's body. Either she's going to get pregnant or she's going to take Plan B and maybe have crappy side effects or something. So I wanted that, you know, really textural feel, and I wanted you to feel like you could reach out and be in their world, but also it kind of like disarms the audience, and I think makes them laugh a little more readily at what's happening.
I think as a female creative and actor filmmaker myself, it's incredibly inspirational to continue to be surrounded by more and more stories that I can relate to on such a personal level, and B, that you can laugh to. I think the fact that you've gone with comedy as these, not like, maybe not even with this purpose of I have to use comedy because this is going to make people uncomfortable. It's just, this is the best way I want to tell my story. I think is incredible. And I'm curious for both of you how that thought process, because I think that can be a struggle in terms of, I don't know about you, but I've felt there's that narrative of, oh, women in comedy, there's still a doubt or a questioning. And which annoys me and frustrates me, but I'm curious, did those blocks ever come up to you? Is it kind of, you know, is that a struggle that you dealt with? Or is it you just, no, this is a story I'm going to say and don't even think twice about it?
I feel like, yeah, I think that's how I react to situations normally, is I just usually find the humor in things. And like you were just saying, women are taught to be polite, or like, yes, you don't really... you know, it's harder for you to respond aggressively when someone's being inappropriate with you in any way. And so I've found that over the years, as I've come into my own and realized I don't want to be treated certain ways, I usually use comedy, and it kind of puts people in their place instead of, so that's part of it. And I think I just like naturally found the comedy in those situations. And I think it's impossible to not find humor in a lot of dramatic scenarios, because when something's so dramatic, you're just like, how is this happening right now? It just seems so absurd to me. In terms of like a roadblock, luckily I've worked with people who are really supportive and really believe in me, and that's been great. But I have had a couple people like come up to me and been like, wow, I didn't realize you were that funny after seeing the film. And I'm like,
the microaggressions.
Yep, I guess I am. So, yeah, it's been good and bad.
Anna Margaret, I was thrilled, to have you on the show because we're friends, we're buddies.
Yeah.
But also, Angela Rawling, who's one of the women who make the show happen, saw a panel while she was up here about the film, or sponsored by the film, Sorry to Bother You, and it had a number of people on it. And the idea of the panel was about what concretely filmmakers can do and what we can do in the efforts of diversity, whether it be getting more women in more highly creative positions, or people of color in roles that aren't just shoehorned for mm-hmm. them. And because you've worked with so many directors, and you are a constant presence in this indie world, I wanted to get your perspective on this, and now especially now that you're stepping behind the camera, what are your thoughts on this?
I'm sorry, on how to
concretely
create.
How filmmakers can really, you know, start making some real measures rather than just talking about it and posting a hashtag or two.
Yeah. Oh man, yeah. Those hashtags. I think there's a thing where I've noticed I'm terrible at social media, and I do think there is this thing where it does feel like people are good at kind of saying they're doing it. I tried for my set to, have a set that was predominantly female, queer friendly, and definitely for people of color as well. I think I have this whole thing, which I feel like attracts like. And so I do think that, you know, if you come out with the true intention of wanting to foster that with your production, which I think you should. I think it's a great opportunity to do it. In general, and maybe I'm just a little too wavy gravy about this, I do think that if you do come out truthfully and say, and make that an agenda and a purpose for you and say, I want to do that and I want to have, you know, mostly women in these positions or, you know, people of color in these positions, I think that in general, you can build that set. You have to be really proactive about it. You can't be lazy.
Right.
You can't then be like, oh, well, so-and-so's, you know, over here, he's kind of a jerk and mildly sexually harasses some of the women, but it's fine. He's a really good first AD.
Right.
Which, believe me, I've also been on sets with female directors, and that has happened. And women have spoken up. And he wasn't fired. So you really have to make that your first priority in your agenda. Because guess what? There are so many talented people out there. And it's good, too, not to, like, you know, talk about, like, I don't want to, like, discount, like, these, you know, white guys we've been working with for years who have had boundary issues. We still need to include them on those sets as well to educate them. And I don't mean to be like, you know, I don't mean to have them.
So just don't automatically put them in movie jail.
Exactly. You know? I mean, I think this is the thing, right? Is like, we have to, like, I would say my set was predominantly, I don't know how to say this. I'm like, why am I trying to not offend white men? Sorry, guys. But I do think that, like, how are we going to make this better, right? So I do think, and they're not all terrible people. And so there is a way to make it a bit more symbiotic, so that we can kind of just go to sets together, have it be a more diverse set, and have everyone feel safe and productive and have a good time.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, you know, again, you know, we got to expand this segment a little bit, but I do, as I wrap it up, to bring it back to the reason we have you both here. Again, we've been talking about two very funny shorts, Maud, which is directed by Anna Margaret Holliman, and Nevada, which is directed by Emily Hoffman. It's great having you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, guys.
We are back on the Daily Buzz. This is John Wildman, and right now we're going to talk about the film Genesis 2.0, which screens in the World Documentary Competition at Sundance. We have with us two directors in the film, Christian Frey and Maxim Arbogaev. And I always love to open these segments by letting our filmmakers introduce our audience. So, Christian, Maxim, which one of you want to tell our audience what the film is about?
We should have to do this job, both of you. But okay, I begin. This film is about people at literally the edge of the world, in deepest Siberia, in the Arctic, and they're seeking for mammoth tusks, for ivory of extinct mammoth. And one day they find an entire carcass. And then a totally different level and layer comes into the film, and that's this future, it's synthetic biology, because they're trying to resurrect the woolly mammoth. So my colleague and my friend now, Maxim, he's my co-director, and he did all the job. He shot the beautiful shots on the New Siberian Islands. He was totally embedded with these guys for 2 months, and I did the second part of the film.
Well, I was very excited to talk to both of you, because I wanted to explore how the film was made, and since I have both of you here, first let's talk about, as Christian, you were just leading into, how the responsibilities of directing the film were divvied up, because we like to talk about how the movies were made. So who did what on this movie?
Well, it's actually the... It's in the film, we see the two worlds, two different worlds, which is kind of, you know, merge in the middle of the film. And my part was New Siberian Islands, which is located in the Arctic Ocean in Siberia. So I did this world, Mammoth Hunter's world, and I was following them for 2 months. And yeah, and you know, we begin the film with the mammoth hunters, and we end with the mammoth hunters. It's kind of arc.
You come full circle.
And Christian, you know, it's kind of a dialogue between two directors, and and Christian Worrells is a scientist, genetic scientist, which has come in like in the film. Like together.
Not sugar. Actually, no, we both had the idea to do the film, but we didn't know each other. So Maxim was the first time in 2012 with his sister. She's a National Geographic photographer on the islands, and he decided to be a filmmaker because he was before a sports guy and he wanted to do a big film. And I was reading a book by George Church. The title is Regenesis, How Synthetic Biology Will Reinvent Nature and Ourselves. An entire chapter within this book is dedicated to the resurrection of the woolly mammoth. And I came across his sister's photos, you know? I mean, I saw the archaic world of these guys seeking for the tusks and click, you know, epiphany. I wanted to do a film. I didn't know him. But then when I contacted his sister, because she took the photos, she told me about her brother and that he's studying now in the best film school in Moscow and that he will probably be the guy who can do that, because it's, you know, 800 kilograms of expedition material. You need weapons on these islands. It's dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah, and it also was interesting, you know, I was dreaming before I met Christian, I was dreaming to do a full-length documentary about the mammoth hunters. And at the same time, when I was dreaming, Christian was dreaming too to do this documentary. It was a kind of parallel, and we didn't know each other. And it was interesting, you know, how we met each other later.
For me, and I see a lot of documentaries, but this one just came out of nowhere. You know, I'm not assuming anybody's going to make a film about mammoth hunters and delve into this topic. And that's why I was really, really curious to find, you know, where this idea came from, because not everybody's traipsing around Siberia, as you say, the edge of the world, you know, making the film. But now that you've brought it up, let's talk about the challenges that are particular to this film. You know, they're routine challenges that every filmmaker has, every documentarian has, but there are very special challenges this film had. Max?
Well, for me, was the big challenge was, like, to get to the small community of these mammoth hunters. And, before the shooting, it was a long preparation to the expedition. We had around, like, 300 kilograms of the equipment. I don't know how many in pounds, but in the beginning we decided to. I was with my assistant there. We were two. We decided to choose the clothes the same like the hunters wear, because we had to be like equal with them, you know, to be the real mammoth hunters. And we shared all food. We share all
struggling, immersing yourself within them.
Yeah, it was important for us, you know, because these guys, they're really special. You know, if you do a wrong step, they will kind of kick you out from this group. And yeah, and you know, I'm from this region. I'm actually was born like not far from this island, like 300 kilometers. It's a small village called Stixi. And they said to me, it was really important for me to be a mammoth hunters, search tusk with them together and follow them and try to not do a wrong step.
And Christian, you guys have collected all the footage, and now the film has to be put together. You know, for you personally, you know, because again, that you as you said, dreamed about making this film. What were the surprises once that footage had, you know, and you're actually, you know, compiling it together? What discoveries did you make at that point?
Well, also I was facing a big challenge, and this is the challenge to shoot in these labs, you know, to kind of show this emerging technology, which is called synthetic biology, and it's not easy. Mm. I didn't want to, you know, to do again the stereotype of the petri dishes and the clean labs. And so my surprise number one was, for example, when we were shooting in Boston, USA, at the, you know, event, an annual event called the Genetically Engineered Machine Competition. I mean, wow, what this title, you know? And so it's 4,000 students meeting there, and they, you know, create new life forms. They kind of go creative with DNA. And the mood there was so jamboree. That's also a name, a title they give to this event. You know, they're all dressed in kind of colored T-shirts. And it looks so funny, but then you think about what they're really doing. It's a little bit scary. But I liked that, you know, because I didn't want to come with this dystopian, wow, it's the end of the world. Even though the film, that was the second gift, if you want, ends up in China, where they want to digitalize everything alive on the earth. I mean, really, literally everything, put it into their computers and begin to edit with it. And they gave us total access to this institute, which is the Chinese National Gene Bank. And what, you know what? Two big mammoth statues are in front of this place. And it's true. What I wrote in my concept and I didn't know about China, the mammoth is the first manifestation of this next great technological revolution. There they were, you know, the two mammoths. So this is a big gift.
Well, I mean, it's a fascinating documentary from the edge of the world and the edge of science. Again, the title is Genesis 2.0. A screening in the World Documentary Competition at Sundance. And we've been talking with Christian Fry and Maxim Arbugaev. Thank you for being here, both of you.
Sure. Thank you very much.
And we are back on The Daily Buzz. My name is John Wildman, and right now we're going to be talking about the film The Writer, which is playing in the spotlight section at Sundance. And we have with us the director, Chloe Zhao. And Chloe, thank you for being here. I just saw the movie last night, and I've been looking forward to seeing it because I had not had a chance to catch it at the other fest that it had played prior here. Before I dig into this, because I've been anxious to dig into it, why don't you introduce the film to the audience who has not had a chance to see it yet.
Okay. The film is called The Writer. It takes place in South Dakota. It's about a young cowboy who suffered a head injury and having to deal with the aftermath of that.
Right. And, you know, your approach on this I found fascinating as far as there is a distinct lack of, so to speak, hysteria in this film that could be there, considering the tragic nature, you know, of Brady, of the main character, and what's going on. And I would love for you to talk about your approach as a director and how you were able to kind of laser in and be so precise, which I thought was wonderful, with the direction of the film, to kind of make sure it stayed on him and on his ordeal?
Well, because I met Brady and was very drawn to the way he trained horses and the way he lived his lives before he got hurt in real life. And he got hurt last April 2016. And so the story kind of presented itself to me. And we shot the film September 2016. So it was very fresh for him, that recovery post-injury. And we had to make that quick while he was still in that vulnerable state. We had to make the film with a really small crew and no budget. So those limitations actually informed how the film is made. I think this is one of those films that thrive within limitations.
Well, I'm so happy you brought that up, because oftentimes we hear when we're talking to filmmakers and filmmakers are talking amongst themselves, how those kind of limitations oftentimes spark the best creativity, because you have no other choice. You have to figure out a solution. You have to figure out an answer. Talk about it. Elaborate on that.
it's a kind of freedom that's not the kind that we were told that we should want.
Right.
But I get to make my own schedule. For example, I knew we had no money for lights. All the lights, I think my cinematographer did a great job on the film.
Wonderful job.
Yeah. All the lights came from Walmart, you know. They're like, who is your lighting package? But we know we have the best light in the world, which is the sun, you know. So we scheduled our shoot completely. I never shoot before 2 p.m. So, and I wrap around like 8:30. And we shot every magic hour for 5.5 weeks. Because then when you know your limitation, then you have to see what your advantage is. And to really, you got to, so your vision sometimes will be compromised, and you have to be willing to do that in order to take these advantages.
And you know, and you know, it's the, you know, the old saying, you don't work with kids or animals, because that's difficult. And you know, shooting around and, you know, and with the horses, can you talk about the challenges there?
Yeah. Well, I think kids and animals they can be anything else but themselves. You know, some might say don't work with non-actors, you know. But then you have to see what kind of film you're making. You know, if you're forcing them exactly how you envision the film, then yes, don't do that. It's really difficult. But if you want what they can give and that you cannot make up, then they're the perfect people to work with. Even Brady's sister, Lily, who is autistic, you know, if you want to force her to do things that you want her to do, it's never going to be as interesting as what she's going to give you. And with the horses, Brady is a horse whisperer. He does that for a living.
Yeah, it's kind of remarkable.
So from 6 a.m. to noon, he will be training horses for his clients. And in the afternoon, he will shoot with me. So we will film him doing that.
I mean, it's funny. As I was watching, I had those thoughts that you know, if I didn't know the backstory, you would go, it can't be this. It's not this easy. Like this is a Hollywood artifice that, you know, that the horse can be brought in. And I'm someone who works with like rescued dogs and feral dogs, yeah, and everything, you know. So on that level, yeah, I know how long it takes, yeah, and how difficult. And yeah, so to watch it, you go, no way. No way.
It's all CGI'd. We actually I had two dogs from the reservation, one per film. They just showed up on my door, and now they're mine. So there's one from the rider. One of the cowboy had them. Yeah.
Wow.
Sorry, sidetracked.
No, that's
you have to have a dog. Dog people know. So
exactly. Exactly. Seriously.
Yeah.
What has it been? I mean, because you know, this is not where the film is premiering. You know, mm-hmm, some audiences have seen it. What has that experience been like for you, as far as what audiences have pulled from the film?
We premiered at Cannes in May, and I was a little worried at the time because what's going on politically in our country, in the world, I felt like, you know, I made a film about, even though they're Native Americans, but they look white, you know, and they have cowboy hats on. Is anybody going to care? But I was really moved throughout the entire journey, having played, you know, New York, Toronto, Telluride, and even in Pingyao in China. You know, these are some really liberal places, but people really want to connect with a group of people that the media tell them that it's just inherently different than who they are. I think deep inside, people want to see the good from the unfamiliar, and they want that.
Yeah.
And I was really moved by the audience reaction.
Well, and that's I was hoping to hear, because you know I knew he had played in really vastly kind of different, mm-hmm, geographical and different countries, yeah, frankly, and wondering, like, how viscerally they got tied into, mm, to Brady and his family,
yeah,
what was going on there.
Yeah.
Well, very cool. Well, again, the title of the film is The Rider, screening in the Spotlight section at Sundance, and we've been talking with the director, Chloe Zhao. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And we're wrapping up day 7 of the Daily Buzz on kcpw.org, moviecitynews.com, and You Offend Me, You Offend My Family. This show is made possible with the support of KCPW and the Slamdance Film Festival. Our sponsors, Studio Movie Grill, which is opening hearts and minds one story at a time, and Onward, a search-driven brand experience agency.
Additional support is provided by Movie City News, The Market in Park City, Ruby Snap, and City Cakes. Our producer is Lanzia Wan.